Members, 1 o'clock having arrived, I'm going to call the March 25th, 2021 meeting of the House Taxes Committee to order under remote House Rules 10.01. Ms. Griska, if you would please take the roll.
Marquardt.
Present.
Marquardt, present. Liz Lagarde.
Present.
Liz Lagarde, present. Davids.
Davids, present.
Davids, present. Bajay.
Present.
Bajay, present. Carlson.
Carlson, present.
Carlson, present. Detmer.
Detmer, present.
Detmer, present. Garofalo. Garofalo. Gomez.
Gomez, present.
Gomez, present. Her. Her. Hertas.
Hertas, present.
Hertas, present. Howard.
Present.
Howard, present. McDonald. McDonald.
McDonald, here.
McDonald, present. Miller.
Miller, present.
Miller, present. Moran. Mortensen.
Present.
Mortensen, present. Robbins.
Present.
Robbins, present. Sandell.
Present.
Sandell, present. Schultz.
Present.
Schultz, present. Stevenson.
Present.
Stevenson, present. Swazinski.
Present.
Swazinski, present. Joachim.
Joachim, present.
Joachim, present. Garofalo. Her. We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Griska. We do have a quorum. Representative Les Lagarde, would you like to move the March 24th, 2021 minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Les Lagarde moves approval of the March 24th, 2021 minutes of the Taxes Committee. Any discussion or thoughts? Members, please temporarily unmute as we vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those say nay. The motion does prevail. The March 24th, 2021 minutes of the House Taxes Committee are approved. I also want to refer you to a March 24th, 2021 memo. Referral memo that went out. And so, members, welcome. It's a nice sunny day. We are here. We have one bill, House File 1689. Representative Gomez, welcome to your committee. Would you like to move the bill?
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. A beautiful day to talk about unrealized capital gains. I'd like to move House File 1689 be held over for possible inclusion in the House tax.
Gomez moves House File 1689 laid over for possible inclusion in the House tax omnibus bill. Representative Gomez, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 1689 taxes investment gains over $1 million at the time of death, as opposed to allowing estates to pass these investments on to heirs tax-free. So right now in our country, and I think most places, the positive returns on an investment are only taxed when the investment's sold. But if you never cash in an investment and you pass it on to an heir, when they eventually sell the asset, that heir would only be taxed on the amount of appreciation above the value at the time they inherited it. So this is sometimes called the stepped-up basis or the stepped-up basis at death. So like if you buy 10 shares of a stock at $10 per share, when you sell them, they're worth $100, then you'd pay tax on that $900 profit you've earned. It would be added to your tax bill. But if you never sell them and pass them on to this heir, the gain is never realized. So again, the heir would use the stepped up basis as the starting point for any eventual tax that they would have to pay on the profit from the sale of the stock. So a House File 1689 would end that policy in Minnesota by assessing investment holdings at the time of the owner's death, taxing these unrealized capital gains over $1 million to like taxing them as income or capital gains owed by the estate of the deceased. This exempts the first $1 million in unrealized gains. So it's only if you are making, if the value that's appreciated over the life of the decedent exceeds $1 million that you'd pay a dime of tax on this. Also, Class 2A agricultural land is exempt. Any amount above that $1 million is again taxed at the same rates as regular income as capital gains. So this is really designed to address the issue of wealth inequality in our country. So I just want to talk a little bit about that. You know, the richest, we hear this kind of like a lot, you know, but it bears repeating because it's really an important thing to think about as we talk about how we allow all people to have opportunity in our state and have a good life in our state. So the richest 1% owns more than 30% of total U.S. wealth. The richest 10% owns almost 70% of total U.S. wealth, and the bottom half of people in the U.S. own 2% of the wealth. This has just gotten worse and worse over time. In the 1990s, the top 1% owned about 23%, where right now they own 31%, and kind of on down the line, every indicator keeps getting worse over time. So what this means is that it's harder and harder for working class people to survive, let alone thrive in this economy. And with wages not keeping up with the costs of childcare, housing, energy, transportation, on down the line, it's harder than ever for those without wealth to fall back on to make it. Inheritances over $1 million are just 3% of all inheritances, but they're 40% of dollars overall. So these are like a very few kind of number of inheritances, but they encompass a large amount of the money that's passed on. This is a racial justice issue. The Federal Reserve, both here and nationally, has said repeatedly that structural racism is an enormous drag on our economy, and that we lose billions of dollars in foregone economic activity and revenue by allowing racial injustice to continue. The reality is that white families own 90% of all wealth in the United States, despite representing just 60% of the population. The average white household has 10 times the wealth of the average Black household. Wealth has been systematically extracted from BIPOC communities, you know, throughout our history of our country, first through the dispossession and genocide of Native people, the exploitation of enslaved African people's labor, and since then through systemic discrimination in employment, mortgages, housing, education, on down the line. African-American people were effectively excluded from the Homestead Act of the 19th century, provisions of the New Deal and of the GI Bill, and these are all public programs, public investment that built wealth over generations, but mostly just in white communities. You know, also, Black people in particular have faced land and resource confiscation through, you know, theft or terror, like the destruction of the Greenwood District, also known as Black Wall Street in Tulsa, or the example that Chair Moran shared just yesterday during our discussion of farmers, of the man who slept with the deed to his land under his pillow. Because the possibility of theft remained a reality into the late 20th century. Mortgage redlining, predatory lending, racial lease covenants, and the slower appreciation of property in BIPOC communities finds us like leads us here to this moment we're in, where we have really deep racialized wealth inequality. And researchers have concluded that intergenerational transfers are the single largest contributor to the racial wealth gap. So this isn't just like passive policy, but we're actively reinforcing wealth inequality. As we know, wealth provides this essential safety net for people. It, you know, often people who have more wealth are able to provide, you know, stable home education to their kids, but also, you know, help their young people buy a house, start a business, kind of have the support and the safety necessary to take risks in our economy. But for the vast majority of us, of Americans, and especially Americans of color, there is no safety net. Policies like the stepped up basis contribute to the creation of a society that fails to provide that safety net for all. I think we like to think of our policies, especially tax policies, as being colorblind. But the thing is, like, when the policies that we have uphold existing racial inequities that are the results of systematic dispossession and exclusion of BIPOC communities over many generations, our policies can't be thought of as neutral or colorblind. our policies are in fact upholding and reinforcing racial inequities. So we've talked in this committee and others about the K-shaped recovery from COVID and how many people are being left out of this recovery. And you know, our Representative Herr talked about it a lot in her presentation of the fifth tier, and the chair has talked about that really important piece about who's able to work outside their home and who's not. Only about half of us own any piece of the stock market. So while, you know, billionaires in our country have made $1.3 trillion in the stock market over the last year, most of us have seen no part of it. You know, the top earners own about 90% of all corporate equity. So while the stock market's helped out a lot who are already rich, it doesn't mean much to most of us. So the status quo here is a loophole that makes the rich richer and the poor poorer. We spend a lot of time here in the legislature attempting to solve the problems that result from unequal access to opportunities and discrimination, even while other policies like this one uphold continued economic inequality. I just wanted to, because I found this like a little confusing, honestly, to understand at first, so I just wanted to go through sort of an example of how this would work. That's like semi-real life. So if you were had the good fortune or like smarts to buy 1,000 shares of Amazon stock in 2001 at $8 a share, that $8,000 investment in 2021 would be worth $3.088 million. So if you sold those stocks for, you know, and you would be taxed on the $3.08 million capital gain. If you pass them on to your heir, then under my policy, if you died and you hadn't sold your stock and you pass it on to the heir, the death would trigger a realization of the 3.08 capital gain. And so then we would take $1 million off of that. So in this scenario, $2.08 million tax according to current income tax brackets. So without any deductions or exemptions, your heir would pay a little less than $200,000 in taxes and would keep $2.882 million out of the $3.08 million in gain. So you'd hold on to 90.5% of the taxable amount and 93.6% of the entire amount. And so I think that that's important for me just because it's like, we maybe have a way of talking about this like, oh, well, if you put this like little moderate tax on this really high amount of money, it's like the end of the world and we're taking all of this money and it's really unfair. But this is really, it's a small amount of taxpayers and it's a relatively modest tax based on the amount of gains that are sometimes passed between generations. So with that, I have a couple testifiers and then I'd love to have a discussion about the bill.
Very good. So thank you very much, Representative Gomez, for that. And we do have five testifiers. We do have one bill. Representative Garofalo and Representative Herr are now here. They're actually joined later. I'm going to come back to members' questions and after the testifiers and so forth. And testifiers, you kind of know the drill, I think, here in Taxes Committee. We do have just one bill. I will allow a maximum of 4 minutes today, but I'm going to stick pretty strict to the 4 minutes at that point. So first testifier, we have Paulette Demers. Paulette Demers, if you would please identify yourself. There you are for the committee and welcome.
Hello, Chair Mark Horton, members of the committee. My name is Paulette Demers and I live in Rochester, Minnesota. I work from home for a company out of Washington, D.C., and am here today in support of HF 1689 and the revenue it would raise to greater fund opportunities for Minnesotans like me. Most Minnesotans don't benefit from the kind of generational wealth transfer that this bill focuses on. I grew up as one of three kids in a poor working class family in rural Glendon, Minnesota. When it was time to venture off on my own, I wasn't able to go to college. My family didn't have the money, and with no college graduates in our family, we didn't have the mindset to prioritize such a thing. with no safety net, not working and going to school was something I couldn't even consider. I am proud to say that my son was the first generation college student in my family and my daughter the second, but getting there has involved hardships that I wouldn't wish on anyone. They both saw the value of continuing education and put themselves through school and worked hard with no help from me because I couldn't. It also involved some good luck because at any point a medical setback or other unforeseen expense could have turned everything upside down. I know that many people start with a leg up in life. I don't feel resentful towards them, towards people whose parents could forever provide financial benefits. But what I do find frustrating is that we live in a society run by those who have reached that level of comfort and privilege and have decided to pull the ladder up behind themselves. Seemingly thinking that those of us without financial privilege are less than or get what we deserve. Even though my life has at times been difficult, I have benefited from many different privileges, particularly the white privilege. I wish that more people would be freed of the difficulties I've experienced. I do not think the world is made a better place by constant threat of homelessness or bankruptcy. If anything, this forces people into short-term thinking, poor decision-making, and unfortunate circumstances. Frustrating is the fact that the very most are granted special permission to pay less than their fair of taxes and have other systemic privileges provided by the government. This bill would not grant opportunity and stability to all those in need, but would at the very least require that those who have benefited from the most give back at the same level. The revenues it would raise would help create stability for people like myself in critical junctures of their lives. I hope you will support it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. DeMers. Did you say you grew up in rural Glendon?
Yes, sir.
Well, what direction from the city of Glendon?
I live right between Glendon and Craigness.
Ah, so you up north.
North.
Yes,
up
well,
north.
My family, first 5 years of my life, I lived on a farm. So until my dad retired, and that was 4 miles south of Glendon. So I wanted
Sounds okay. So the Krabanoffs and all that crew.
Yes. All right.
All right.
Thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you. Next, we've got Melissa Heising. Melissa Heising, please state your name and welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. My name is Melissa Heising, and I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO, the state labor federation of more than 1,000 local unions who represent more than 300,000 working people throughout Minnesota. COVID-19 has exacerbated the racial and economic disparities that existed before the pandemic. Those at the top have increased their wealth while Minnesotans who were already struggling are being left further behind. We support proposals to raise revenue from the wealthiest taxpayers to fund Minnesotans' needs, including House File 1689. As I was seeking to understand this bill, I was actually shocked to learn that unrealized capital gains can be passed along tax-free. I was shocked because my family was one of the relatively few in Minnesota that has been impacted by the estate tax, back when the exclusion was $1 million instead of $3 million. I'm a fifth generation Minnesotan. My great-great-grandfather immigrated here and began farming on native land. He started a bank in a small town in Isani County in 1914. The bank served a farming community and was renowned for surviving an attempted robbery as well as the Great Depression. In 1933, the bank moved to a larger nearby town to replace the banks that had failed there. According to a family story, my grandpa and his brother got up in the middle of the night during a blizzard to help shovel out and save the turkeys at a nearby farm because the bank held their mortgage and didn't want to foreclose on the farm. The bank was passed down through the generations, and when my grandpa died almost 20 years ago, his estate was subject to the estate tax, which at the time applied to portions of estates over $1 million. The state had realized capital gains, and his six heirs, my mother and her five siblings, ended up inheriting less money than they would have without the estate tax. Despite Minnesota's estate tax laws, my grandpa continued to live in Minnesota until the day he died. All of his children still inherited money, and most of them continue to live in Minnesota to this day. His grandchildren, including myself, benefited from Minnesota's tax system. We graduated from fully funded public schools that offered art, music, home ec, and shop classes, and we learned how to drive on smooth, well-maintained roads. Another branch of the family continues to run the bank and serve the community. Because of my family's experience, I assumed that estates were taxed on their full value. And again, I was in disbelief to learn that they are not. All Minnesotans, no matter their zip code or what they look like, deserve the same opportunities that I had. We can create those opportunities with more just tax policies like House File 1689. Those who have prospered during these difficult times should pay more in taxes to fund Minnesotans' needs. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, and I will stand for questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Heising. I would ask testifiers to do please stick around after you're done with your testimony. Next, Eric Bernstein.
Chairman Marquardt, members of the committee, my name is Eric Bernstein. Thank you for having me. I'm the policy director at Remake Minnesota, and I'm pleased to have the opportunity to share my support for HF 1689, which would end the stepped-up basis at death by taxing unrealized gains over $1 million. The stepped-up basis is one of the most regressive and economically counterproductive tax policies in America. By effectively erasing unrealized gains, the stepped-up basis actually functions as a double tax break, nullifying both capital income taxes and estate taxes. And by rewarding taxpayers for letting their wealth stagnate, it prevents a more productive allocation of capital and discourages consumption. The effect is to reduce economic activity and hamper growth. Perhaps worse than that, however, is how the stepped-up basis feeds our country's already staggering wealth inequality. The latest data shows that the richest 10% of Americans own more than 70% of total U.S. wealth, while the bottom 50% holds just 2%. The wealth distribution is also highly racialized. White households represent just 60% of the country's population, but own 90% of its capital. Sociologists and economists have identified intergenerational transfers as the key driver of these inequities, and the Federal Reserve has warned repeatedly that our extreme levels of racial and economic inequality form a powerful drag on our economy. It should be obvious why. You can't work if you can't afford childcare, you can't go to college if you're caring for sick loved ones, and starting a business is nearly impossible without some sense of security to fall back on. With some of the worst racial disparities in the country, the economic loss to Minnesota is likely worse than almost anywhere else. By favoring policies like the stepped-up basis over sensible investments in the building blocks of economic participation, we are precluding a more prosperous and equitable future. We are choosing wealth retention over wealth creation. It is recalcitrant, and it makes our economy weaker and less dynamic. It cannot be overstated. The stepped-up basis represents the worst kind of backwards-looking fiscal policy, an arbitrary reward for dynastic wealth that would be right at home in feudal Europe. Rather than further enriching those already profiting secondhand from a vibrant economy, why don't we work to extend meaningful opportunity to all Minnesotans? This bill would not fund all of the things we need, but it could raise meaningful revenue for investments in those with the least. Representative Gomez had a testifier visit just last week who demonstrated the enormous fiscal costs of some of the investments we are not making. This bill could fund her proposed relief for homeless students with plenty left over. I know we will likely hear a lot, as we always do, about how this bill encourages migration and lowers revenue. I imagine these arguments were the same in 2006 when federal policy changes substantially increased the impact of state-based estate taxes. Many states abandoned their estate taxes out of these fears, but Minnesota did not, and decades later, it is clear that we have benefited from ignoring these false alarms and putting our needs first. Many people already retired to warmer climates, but as Ms. Heising's testimony showed, those that remain are at peace with their taxes. So as much as tax migration is a useful one-size-fits-all response to any proposed tax increase, I think we should pause to consider how many times we are prepared to believe that the sky will fall this time. In closing, I will add that the stepped-up basis is so utterly without justification that it is a rare example of a tax break for the wealthy that even the Conservative Tax Foundation doesn't like. In a 2019 report, they said that repealing the policy would encourage capital gains realization, remove a tax expenditure that allows returns on savings to avoid taxation, and make the tax code more neutral. So, with both sides agreeing, I look forward to a unanimous discussion by the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we have John Phelan. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Hello there. This is my first time doing one of these, so just to check that you can hear me okay.
Yes, we can.
Fantastic. Well, my name's John Phelan. I'm an economist at the Center of the American Experiment. We're a think tank based in Golden Valley, and I'm here to speak against this bill. Now, as you've just heard, actually, on its own, ending the stepped-up basis on death is not actually the worst idea that there is. And I would say that having something like that is preferable to having an estate tax. And you could say that, you know, you could trade this for abolishing the estate tax, such as Minnesota currently has. One of the problems is that this bill does not propose to replace Minnesota's estate tax. It simply proposes to add yet more tax to a state whose residents are already some of the most heavily taxed in the United States. I'd like to make a quick rejoinder to a point about tax migration. You often hear people kind of wave their hands and say, oh, it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. Unfortunately, those people are speaking in complete ignorance of the evidence. I have this paper here. I don't know if you can see it. It's called Taxation and Migration, Evidence and Policy Implications. You can find it on the National Bureau of Economic Research website. But in it, four economists, they do a literature review, and they summarize the research that there has been into the effect of taxation on migration. And they find, and I shall just quote them here, there is growing evidence that taxes can affect the geographic location of people both within and across countries. And if you read further into it, you'll find that particular groups of the population are particularly likely to move. And unfortunately, for a bill like this, one of the sections of the population is particularly footloose is the rich. There are two further specific problems with this bill. First, the $1 million threshold is, as far as I can see, not indexed for inflation. So with bracket creep, you're going to have more and more Minnesotans hit with this tax over time. Secondly, the bill apparently contains no accommodation for spouses. It may treat a married couple differently, depending on whether they both die in the same year versus whether they die in separate tax years. So as it stands, this bill is both badly conceived and poorly drafted. And on those grounds, we oppose it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Beth Cadoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Most of our 6,300 members are small and mid-sized businesses. We are testifying in opposition to Representative Gomez's bill, as this will make Minnesota even more of a tax outlier for the estate tax, and we don't believe any other state or the federal government imposes an estate tax on unrealized capital gains as this bill does. This will impact a lot of small business owners with a much higher tax burden on their businesses when they try to pass along their family businesses or these assets. It is important for Minnesota to consider what is happening in other states to understand the potential impact of tax policies in our state. There was a handout that was sent to you by Nathan that I hope you can take a look at, and this shows all the Minnesota compared to all the other states. And you can see Minnesota is only one of 12 states that even has an estate tax, and most of those other ones are on the West and East Coasts. Even high tax states such as California and New Jersey no longer have this tax, nor do all of our neighboring states. The trend has been in other states either to eliminate the estate tax or to at least increase the threshold to match the federal. New Jersey and Delaware recently repealed their tax, and also in recent years, Tennessee, Georgia, Indiana, and North Carolina also repealed their taxes. Of the estates with an estate tax, Minnesota's estate tax threshold, where it's triggered, is much lower than about half of those other states, and much, much lower than the federal threshold of 11.7 million. So other states have moved away from this tax, and some of their reports and reasons are as follows. And this was in a Delaware report by their Economic and Financial Advisory Council. They found the estate tax is a small, volatile source of tax revenue and recommended its repeal, which they did do, based in part on its negative influence on personal income tax revenues. A Connecticut Department of Revenue study found the estate tax was a key factor in migration of certain taxpayers. In our state, we've heard from many CPAs, estate tax planners, and others that the estate tax is a lot of times that trigger or tipping point by that higher wealth individual on their decision on where they're going to reside, if they're going to leave Minnesota or not. This tax also violates many tax policy principles, as it has a high compliance burden. It's very inefficient. It violates neutrality, which means the tax code should result in decisions that are made on their economic merits and not for tax reasons. We urge your opposition to this bill that would create even more of a financial disincentive for our higher net worth individuals to remain in Minnesota and create even more costs and complications for many small business owners. Thank you.
Thank you very much, testifiers. Thank you. We're going to move to members' questions. And Representative Swedzinski, you had your hand up first before the testifiers.
So, yes.
Representative Swedzinski.
Mr. Chair, members, just kind of a general question. You know, how will this affect, you know, so I know there's investments that are inside the state, outside the state. You know, what would an investment broker have to do to just move those before someone's passed, or if the person that is actually inheriting the property is actually resides outside of the state, how would that process work?
I think I'm going to ask staff on this, Mr. Clayman, Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair and Representative Swedzinski. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Swedzinski, the House File 1689, that would impose a tax on the unrealized gains of a decedent on their final Minnesota tax return. And so if that individual, and so whatever rules apply to the individual income tax for residents and non-residents would apply in this instance. So that's how that would be handled. As far as the heir, this doesn't affect the capital gains rule on the sale of that creates the stepped up basis under the capital gains rules. So it wouldn't necessarily matter where the heir is located when they receive the inherited property.
Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you. And then just a general question too. You know, obviously we heard a lot of the reason for this is the BIPOC community. Would the author of the bill be open to an amendment to exclude folks from the BIPOC community from this tax?
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Swedzinski. I believe that would violate the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, so I don't think I could support such an amendment.
Representative Swedzinski.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question for the author, but just a really fast commentary on it. I think there's some good points that are being made drawn up by this bill, but the one presumption is always seems to be that government's the answer, and let's take the money, give it to government, and they'll figure out a way to deal with that. I think if government could incentivize instead ways for this to happen in the to promote this in the private sector, that would be more beneficial for everyone. But the question that I have for Representative Gomez, I'm looking on lines 2.6 through 2.8. It's one of the non-taxed capital asset means the capital asset is defined by the Internal Revenue Code, but does not include land classified as 2A agricultural homestead. And so I see the word homestead. And so the question that I have for the author, or maybe for research to answer this, is non-homesteaded assets considered taxable under this bill?
Mr. Clayman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Miller, so any unrealized gain on agricultural non-homestead land would be included in the determination of, you know, whether there are unrealized gains that would exceed the threshold under the bill. So the ag non-homestead land would be included.
Okay.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Clayman. Mr. Chair, Mr. Clayman. I get mixed up on which direction I'm going here. thank you for that information. And members, that's a significant concern out by me, because most land that is owned is not homesteaded, and so it would be subject to this. And we run into the same estate problems, to where land has increased in value over the years, but it gets transferred to a descendant as a farm, and it doesn't really have cash associated with it, but it will have a tax. And what happens is that you end up actually having to sell off the farm just to pay the taxes. And I don't think that's an intended consequence of what we're trying to do here. And so I would encourage Representative Gomez moving forward to maybe clarify that, because that's really ends up being a gotcha moment. And I know that she isn't intending to do that, but that's a real problem with the assets in Roma. So I'll tell you, a million dollar threshold on that, when land is down in price out by me now, and it's still $9,000 an acre, that adds up in a real hurly. It does not take a very large farm at all for them to have this tax implication on this. One more quick question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I was going to ask the question, I almost hesitated. But, oh, now I remember the word. Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gomez, how is a trust reflected in this bill if something was put into a trust?
Represent or Mr. Clayman, maybe that's best for staff.
Sure.
Yep, Mr. Chair. So let me just take a look at the actual wording. So this would be an addition under the individual income tax, and it would apply, and these additions would apply to individuals, estates, and trusts. So the proposed addition would also apply to a trust.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Clayman.
You bet. Thank you, Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gomez.
Oh, I just quickly, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Miller, thank you for the questions. On the farm example, any tax that's owed on the unrealized gains above $1 million would only be assessed when the asset was sold. And so it's not a case where when the land gets passed on to the heir, that they then owe that money right then. So then they're in a position where they're trying to deal with a non-liquid asset that they owe money on. It's when it's sold down the line, or if it's sold. It's that the tax, that's the appreciation, goes from the original purchase, not from that stepped up basis. So just to clarify.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, could you have
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair, could you have Mr. Clayman clarify that? Because I found ag land when it transfers through an estate to be different.
Yeah.
I mean, unless it's in the trust.
You bet. You bet. That's very good, Representative Miller. Mr. Clayman.
Mr. Chair, I guess this may be something I need to spend some time researching, and how does this work when you've got trusts involved in transfers, intergenerational transfers? I guess I'll just say if the unrealized gain exceeds the threshold, then that gain is going to be subject to the tax. And there might be a question, to the personal representative of the decedent, who would be responsible for filing the decedent's final tax return, and others, how to pay that tax. And I suppose there could be a question about, whether some of the assets of the decedent should be sold in order to pay the tax. But beyond that, as far as getting into the particulars of, what happens in the case of transfers via trust, I'd want to go back and research that a little bit before providing an answer.
Thank you, Representative Miller, for bringing that up. Representative Bajie.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. I had a clarification question for one of our testifiers, so I think I'm going to direct this question to Mr. Bernstein. On the issue of the tax migration, you said that that's not actually really an issue. Do you have any other studies to back that up, or do you have a rebuttal for other comments?
Mr. Bernstein.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt and Representative Bajie for the question. I agree with Mr. Thielen that there is conflicting evidence on this, but I think it's where we disagree is more on the interpretation. I was surprised a little bit at the study. I am familiar with the study that was mentioned. It's mostly, as I understand it, in an international context. There are many studies that look at this tax migration specifically in a state-by-state context, and the evidence there is also mixed. But that study that was cited, I think one important point to keep in mind is there's a difference between detecting an effect and interpreting a response that we should have, you know, in the policy arena. And actually in the abstract, that report contains the warning, and I'll just read it. While migration responses add to the efficiency cost of redistributing income, we caution against overusing the recent evidence of sizable mobility responses to taxes as an argument for less redistribution in a globalized world. So I think that a lot of these effects are considered large by economic standpoint or standards. But, you know, when we talk about like sort of as we talk in budget context and revenues, that, you know, they're an effect of an effect. So I think there's a scaling problem. There was a very famous study done in California, and it showed what many economists considered to be a huge effect. But when you actually did the math, it was 53 individuals who left the state, I believe. And so I think there's that problem. And then I think there's a separate problem with is, yes, some people are tax sensitive. Businesses and people can both be tax sensitive, but different kinds of businesses are tax sensitive. So, for example, Texas gets a lot of financial companies that are highly tax sensitive. Minnesota has been a high tax state, relatively speaking, for some time. And so we're less likely to get those businesses, but that is already true. So there's a degree to which higher taxes might, you know, change like sort of who comes here and who goes. But that's already been happening. So the notion that every time we raise taxes, now we're going to have this mass exodus doesn't really follow from the evidence, at least that I've seen. That's kind of my response.
Thank you. Representative Bajie.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Yeah, I guess my final comments would really just be, you know, I really appreciate Representative Gomez for bringing something like this forward. I think it is time to have this conversation about, you know, the wealth inequality, not only in this country, but also in the state, and what we can do to begin to address those issues. And I think this is a step in the right direction. It's obviously tempered to make sure that the threshold is at $1 million. And I think it would do a lot to make sure that we are having the resources that we need to invest in our systems rather than waiting and relying on a strategy of benevolence through charity. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the author of the bill, how many other states do it the way you're proposing?
Representative Gomez.
I would have to turn that over to maybe Mr. Bernstein. Do you know the answer to that question, or Mr. Klayman?
Yeah, Mr. Klayman, do you have an answer to that? Other states doing this type of an approach?
Chair, you know, I haven't done any, you know, exhaustive 50-state survey on this, but to my knowledge, I don't think there are any other states that impose an unrealized gain at death. Again, I'd have to research that to be sure, but.
Thank you. Representative Garofalo.
Does Mr. Bernstein want to chime in to validate that?
Mr. Bernstein, did you want to?
Yeah, that's correct. Chair Marquardt, thank you. It's a good question. That is correct. No other states tax unrealized gains of death.
Very good. Representative Garofalo.
So, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Bernstein, this is such a progressive, forward-thinking, and smart policy that California hasn't even done this?
Representative Gomez, are we better off than California?
Well, according to all of the rankings of good places to live, we are. But California, being one of the other 50 states that doesn't have this policy in place, doesn't have this policy in place. That's correct.
And Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and Representative Gomez, your comments in support of this bill were referenced quite a bit of equity, particularly racial equity. It would seem to me that given that the minority community was disproportionately impacted by unemployment last year, that we should be passing the exclusion and taxes for unemployment from last year. That would be a much more immediate and strong way to help out the minority communities in our state. Am I correct?
Representative Garofalo, we will be doing that.
Well, but Mr. Chairman, you're doing it tying it to tax increases that won't become law. So that's why I want an answer to my question.
Representative Garofalo, our bill will be coming out, probably done out of committee by April 8th. And you will have plenty of opportunity to vote for tax cuts and aid to businesses and
but families. Mr. Chairman, my question is, in prioritizing this bill, wouldn't we be better served by immediately passing the tax exclusion for unemployment benefits? It's a question for Representative Gomez, and
Representative Chairman, Gomez,
she's fully capable of answering it.
Representative Garofalo, I know that. I just want to be clear of what the timetable was for this tax committee, which I chair. And that's why I mentioned we're going to have a tax bill out, hopefully out of committee by April 8th, 2 weeks from today. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo. I look forward to a tax bill that takes care of all Minnesotans, including small businesses that didn't turn a profit, including people on unemployment, including people who received assistance from the federal government. And, I think that we're going to see that bill in a week and a half, and we can talk more about it then.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Gomez. I want to appreciate you in following the chair and not answering my question. I respect that and I understand it. But the reality is, if people want to talk about equity and fairness, if you want to help ethnic minorities in our state, the first, best, and original way you can do that is right now, passing the exclusion on unemployment insurance benefits right now. I assume that every member of this committee is getting the emails that I am getting from people who are filling out their taxes and are finding out that they, even though they were unemployed last year, they owe a huge tax bill to the state of Minnesota. So if the stated goal of helping ethnic minorities and helping these communities is what the motivation is for members, I think that is the best way that we can do that right now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank you for hearing this bill. I think we need to have more public discussions about wealth inequality. And we need to educate the public about our options for reducing wealth inequality and inequity. And so I thank Representative Gomez for bringing the bill forward. I appreciate Mr. Phelan's comment as a representing a conservative think tank that he believes this is a sound tax policy. And I also want to note that the study he cited, and thank you, Mr. Bernstein, for helping me do my job, but it's an MBER working paper. It hasn't been peer reviewed. It hasn't been published. It came out in 2019. And it looked at international different countries, but also looked at superstar football players and inventors. So it's not, you can't extrapolate to a broader population about people's behavior when tax policy changes. If we look at the empirical evidence in our own country, when other states have imposed higher taxes on wealthier individuals and households, they did not see an outmigration of wealthy people. In fact, in many states, wealthier people move to that state after a change in tax policy. So I think we have to be careful about what the studies suggest and the implications of those studies. But if we can just look at the simple empirical evidence of after a tax policy passes in a state, are people moving in or out, and are they the wealthy individuals? And that evidence does not support Mr. Phelan's conclusion based on that one study evaluating policies that are not as pertinent or relevant to this discussion. I also want to say that it's very hard to do a sound study because we don't have secondary data to answer these questions because people move for a variety of reasons. It's not just tax policy. And the studies, we don't have all of the data to actually answer that question. So we have to look just at the empirical information rather than a sound economic research study. So thank you again, Representative Gomez, for bringing this forward. And I hope we can continue having discussions in the public about tax policies to address a huge variation in wealth in our state and our country.
Mr. Phelan, you've been named a few times. Would you like any comments on this? And then we're going to kind of end the talk on the study and move forward. But go ahead, you can have the last word. Mr. Phelan, you're still muted.
There you go. Hi there. Can you hear me now?
We can.
Several points. One is that to say that this is an MBER study, it's not been published, it hasn't been peer reviewed, that doesn't mean that this is, kind of cat litter liner. The MBER is very well respected. It's where most major research gets goes through. It attracts comments, it attracts feedback, and then it ends up in a journal article. So that's not really much of a point. A second point is that this is actually a review article. It reviews all the research that there is out there. And so to say, as you just heard, oh, the research doesn't say this, the research doesn't say that, it's just not true. You're not being told the truth. To repeat, this is a quote from the end of this here. There is growing evidence that taxes can affect geographic location of people both within and across countries. So this does actually also reflect research that shows within country migration in response to tax hikes. And it does find that particular portions of the population, not everybody is equally likely to move because taxes get hiked, but particular portions are. And unfortunately for this bill and bills like it, the rich are most likely to move. There's another report that came out again. It's the MBER. By economists Daniel Wilson and Enrico Moretti, and they actually looked at the estate tax. And they found that in most cases, the estate tax brings in more revenue for a state in the United States than it loses. So you think that's a good thing? Well, they actually found that was true for most states, but not all states. The states where they found that the estate tax lost revenue by pushing people out, Minnesota was one of them. In fact, all the states that lost revenue, according to Moretti and Wilson's research, as a result of this of the estate tax, were states with high rates of income tax. So economists have to talk about trade-offs. There's a trade-off here. You can have a high estate tax or you can have a high income tax, but you can't have both. And just as a final point, we've been hearing all year, follow the science, follow the data. Here it is. And because it's inconvenient, people are saying, don't follow it, don't listen to it. Listen to anything else but that. I think if you're going to have smart evidence-based policy, you have to be honest about what the evidence says.
Very good. And so the conclusion here is it's a mixed bag. And the Minnesota research, House research also looked at migration in a September 2018 study and said that the big migration in and out is people under 30. It's not, you know, using typically people. So all sorts of studies out there. And Mr. Phelan, I wanted to give you a chance because they have kind of a rebuttal because it's going back and forth and we've had that. But we talk a lot about migration, but you can kind of pick and choose migration studies and they just are very, very inconclusive, as I think what we just heard indicates. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. I just had a really quick question for Representative Gomez or one of our researchers, but I'm just curious, is short-term and long-term capital gains treated the same? So let's say that asset that person had was less than a year old, but you know something happens to them and then they transfer that and it hasn't been a year. I know that normal capital gains are treated a little bit different for short-term versus long-term. So will they both be handled differently or the same in this situation?
Representative Gomez, would you like to answer that?
Can I kick it to Mr. Klayman, please?
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, so the way that the bill is structured, the unrealized gains would be included in a decedent's final tax return if they were a capital asset. It'd be determined based on the gain on that capital asset and whether under existing law those gains would be included in federal adjusted gross income. So if you had a gain that was short or long term and under the current rules those gains would be included in FAGI, then they would be included in this calculation under this bill.
Representative Herr.
Wonderful, thank you for that explanation. I just wanted to also thank Representative Gomez for bringing this bill forward. I know I know you and I've had a lot of discussions around this, and I think that you are one of the people who talk a lot about how government doesn't always know best and that, you know, it's people that know best. And so I know that when you bring this bill forward, it's not because you think government knows better and should be getting this money. It's that you are very well aware that government is what created the laws and which created the inequities, and it is up to government to fix those laws so that we don't continue to keep certain people back from owning and generating wealth and passing it on. I do just want to say that because equity is such a big focus, and I've heard that multiple times in this committee, I do have a $15 minimum wage bill that I think that then everybody here should be able to support. And I'm looking forward to the support of that, since equity seems to be really important to all of us here. And I just want to say that pay history bill is coming up on the floor. And if we want to be able to have people have income so that they can generate wealth, these are all great bills for you all to get behind today with me. So thank you.
Thank you. We've got Representative McDonald and Representative Sandell, and then we're going to go to final comments. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a question for Representative Gomez. But before that, I just want to, well, I'll just ask my question, Representative Gomez. Just what impact does making the unemployment pay higher taxes this time have to do on wealth inequality? And of course, I ask that because we brought earlier that currently right now, although Chair, you say it's going to be in April 8th is the bill, but we can do something now. People are filing their taxes now, paying their taxes now, and or delaying it.
Representative McDonald, we are on House File 1689. What's your question for Representative Gomez?
I'll repeat it. What impact does this unemployment, making the unemployment pay higher taxes, have to do with wealth inequality?
Representative Gomez, how does 1689 react to other bills?
I mean, the unemployment, our treatment of unemployment is not really an issue here. So I guess you're asking, I mean, I'm trying to understand what, if you would actually like an answer from me, then I would ask you to restate the question, I guess. But if you want to make a point, you should probably do that.
Yeah. Representative McDonald, I think you're making more of a point than a question, which is fine. But
is there more? Mr. Chair, then the point's been made. Representative Gomez, thank you. I won't make it again. But I do have to ask a question. You said in your testimony, in your opening statement, that Americans of color, there is no safety net. And now I've been to the legislature for 11 years, and I know that great, great folks in the legislature, Democrats and Republicans, that have worked very hard to ensure safety nets for all people, people of color, no matter what races, creed, or nationality. And being on the Health and Human Services for 6 years, I've worked hard on making sure there are safety nets. And I'm wondering why you would say such a thing, that for Americans of color, there's no safety net, when we spend billions of dollars in the state taking care of people of all colors, races, and creeds of color, when truly the good work of this legislature, and Representative Marquardt's one of them, many others, done wonderful things. Can we be better? Yes. But we've done and cared for many folks with great safety nets. So just wonder, why would you say that in regards to no safety nets?
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative McDonald. So when I said that for the vast majority of Americans, especially Americans of color, have no such safety net, referring to the safety net of generational wealth that unfortunately not everyone has access to, which is what I referred to in my testimony. So when I said that, I was talking about, it was particularly referring to what it means for a young adult kind of getting started in, on their career and in their life to have the economic security provided by intergenerational wealth that's been transferred to them. You know, I think that it creates a possibility for, you know, assistance with a down payment on a home, or, you know, help starting up a business, or kind of that ability to take a risk, especially, you know, early on in life, is something that frankly is not afforded to the vast majority of Americans. So that's what I was referring to when I made that comment. And I did say the vast majority of Americans, especially Americans of color, because, you know, that was referring back to that disproportionality that I covered in the earlier part of my testimony.
Representative McDonald.
I think, though, and I'll close this quickly. Okay. I see my internet is unstable. Can you hear me now, Mr. Chair?
You're cutting out a little bit, but you're okay now.
These darn old buildings. I just caution you, Representative Gomez, and me too, all of us, that the people judge us by the words we choose, and words have meaning. So when we paint with a broad brush, it really disenfranchises those who are in the legislature and city halls and county commissioners that are doing the best to take care of those who don't have homes or are struggling to meet ends meet. So to paint with a broad brush to say there's no safety nets kind of indicates that we're not doing good work down here. And although we're not perfect, we are doing good work for all types of people. So I just cautioned you to paint not with such a broad brush and be a little more careful in some of the words you choose, and I'll do the same. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt, and Representative Gomez. I like your bill. It's interesting. I've had many conversations with Mr. Klayman and his associates in House Research. And when it comes to the issue of taxing inheritance on assets which have grown in value, House File 712 solves that problem by taxing the decedent on his death or her death on those on the increased value of those assets. That solves two problems. One, it collects the revenue you're looking for, and second of all, it protects the individual who is inheriting the asset from being taxed on revenues that his or her father or mother or whomever allowed that inheritance. So you could solve the problem that way, taxing the decedent at time of death. On the issue of migration, I want to say that that issue has been discussed often. And I was reading a biography of Floyd B. Olson a little while ago, and I have to say that the Republicans were threatening Governor Olson that they would leave the state or wealth would leave the state. And the thing that was threatening them was the unemployment insurance. We've added unemployment insurance and, in fact, have attracted people to our state. So I think that benefits like we're talking about would probably not result in people fleeing Minnesota for California. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Gomez, closing comments.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks to the members of the committee and to Mr. Klayman for all his pitching. When we come together, we can have a world where all of us have access to the basic things everyone needs for a good life: safe and stable housing, clean land and water, education, childcare that meets our kids' needs, a well-trained workforce, infrastructure, safe communities. These are the things that families, that businesses, that human beings need to thrive. When we don't invest in the common good, the human and economic costs are high, as we saw in the presentation that we had by Dr. Foldis when I presented my Housing First for Kids aid. We cannot live in a world where people have the ingredients for a good life if we don't ask those who have the most to modestly contribute to our shared future. This, like the other revenue raisers we've heard recently, would have a moderate impact on a very small number of people who are doing exceptionally well in this economy. It would benefit the public good and allow us to invest in a shared future that can be bright for everyone. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gomez, thank you so much for bringing this bill forward and for bringing this discussion to the table in the legislature. Greatly appreciate it. And thank you, everyone, for your discussion today. So, Representative Gomez, renews her motion to layover House File 1689 for possible inclusion into the omnibus tax bill. Chair Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for the robust debate. I hope that everybody has a great Easter Passover spring break holiday here. Get some rest, because when we get back, we have a lot of work to do. Thanks, everyone. Have a super weekend.
Thank you very much for that. And I think that's a great way to end. Members, thank you for your work today and up to this point, and have a wonderful and blessed break. And with that, we are adjourned.